We want the babies to sleep, right? Tiny babies aren't known for their slumbering skills. Parents, of course, know this. In a maternity ward, calming incubators and respirators keep the little folks calm down. Aww. But what if this scene was actually something completely different? Coming up on The Takeaway, the eerie premise of the latest novel in our book club series, these machines aren't lulling babies to sleep in this novel. They are harvesting sleep, like futuristic milking machines, taking precious baby sleep to save a dying world of insomniacs.
Hundreds of our old neighbors, friends, co-workers, and teachers are new insomniacs. They file for dream bankruptcy, appeal for slumber core aid, wait to be approved for a sleep donor. It is a special kind of homelessness, says our mayor, to be evicted from your dreams. I believe our mayor is both genuinely concerned for his insomniac constituency and also pandering to a powerfully desperate new voting bloc.
That's book club friend Lou Elder reading a selection from Karen Russell's Sleep Donation. It's the next pick in our Takeaway book club. Lou is one of the jolly book babes of Malvern, Pennsylvania, formed 17 years ago, with nearly 190 books, including Sleep Donation.
I loved it. I fell in love with the idea. I like science fiction, psychological thrillers, and I thought it's a cautionary tale, and we're not too far away from this sort of thing.
That's Joni Bedina, the founder of Book Babes, and here's Diane Weltman, who you might say is the chief foodie of the group, but she had mixed feelings about A World of Insomniacs.
I thought the book was incomplete. It doesn't give us all the answers, but it definitely generates a tremendous discussion, so I recommend it for book clubs for that very reason.
Lou Elder, a mother of four, knows a thing or two about being kept up at night. She said Sleep Donation did not keep her up.
I fell asleep 6 times reading this book. I did. And it's not because it was boring. It was definitely a great discussion book, but it's not something I would have handed to someone to read on the beach.
The book babes of Malvern, Pennsylvania have been chewing over the Karen Russell novella Sleep Donation, this idea of a future America destroyed by insomnia, and a young protagonist named Trish, who works for a bizarre charity to save the world. It's kind of the Matrix meets a traditional blood drive, a way to get people to donate their excess sleep to those suffering this life-threatening insomnia. Well, the book babes explain how the concepts of sleep, charity, and grief take on a whole new meaning throughout the story. Joni Bedina begins.
And the notion that it becomes almost like you would come to think of blood, you know, and it reminded me a lot of early on in the AIDS crisis, you know, the notion of donating and should you donate and what happens if you donate and is there contamination? And it was that sleep, we take it for granted, but it's like air, it's like food, all of the things that we need.
Well, the idea is really amazing because you've got these two donors in the book. One is Baby A, this completely innocent baby who turns out to be a universal donor. Baby A's sleep can go into anyone. And then you've got this donor Y, whose dreams can turn people into terrified, antisocial. They're essentially kind of toxic because the dreams go along with the sleep. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how you contrasted Baby A with this other donor.
Well, Baby A is being used. I mean, she has no vote in it whatsoever. She is being harvested. And among our book club members, we struggled with that greatly, that the mother was so willing to give her over. And she has no say in the matter. So she's... It's the innocence of her that is very challenging. But I thought if I had the ability to save one of my children with this, I would do it. But would I give over one of my children to do this? I don't know. I don't think I would. And then poor donor Y, everyone sees him as the devil, and he's just this regular guy who...
Well, we think he's... We don't know. Do we ever really know?
No, it's really
his intention.
Trish's interpretation of it, Joni.
Yeah, which is interesting because you'd like to think that he just was doing his part, but in the process contaminated the supplies, which was a nightmare, literally, and figuratively.
And speaking of children, and this is open to all of us, but would you give over your child for a cause like this? Really, I struggle with that one a lot because I thought I think I'm this altruistic person. And
the father was more protective.
Yes.
And in a way that I think women expect mothers to be. Mm. So the mother was kind of protecting society, but she wasn't necessarily protecting her child. And that was an interesting thought for us because she's doing a good thing. But I think every one of us, all nine of us, sort of, we're all moms in this group. And now, by this time, we're all moms. And I think it was this notion of, ooh, start at home. You know, take care of the people at home before you save the world. Mm. I think every mom at that at our table felt that. And the father was really being more protective.
I think Felix was the most human of all the characters. And he's the person that really helped Trish arc and come to enlightenment, for lack of a better word, on what was really going on and what her role was.
Yeah, he knew to get these people attached to the present instead of the grief of losing the sister.
Yes.
Would give her compassion for his child because she wasn't really thinking of baby A. She was thinking of the loss of her sister and how do you fill that and how do you fill that and how do I work through that grief? Mm-hmm. And he was able to say, you connect. He knew enough, connect with me, connect with the realness of this. He brought her to the present instead of just being numbed by her pain.
Can any of you envision this grief experience becoming a life-defining experience where you really have to go on a journey that this grief is propelling you forward on?
I absolutely identify with the notion of this person's gone, but the pain that you're experiencing is a way to keep him or her present in your life, even though it's not a pleasant way. They're gone, the energy's gone, but it has been replaced with the feeling of missing. And there is, at least for me, there has been this fear of what happens if I let that go? Does this person disappear completely? And as crazy as it sounds, the pain of the loss keeps that person alive in some way, that the fear of losing even that becomes more terrifying. And boy, did I get that.
How do you know that? Where does that come from?
My mother passed away when I was 9. She was 43. And at that point, you know, you think she's old, but I'm 47 now, you know.
You're old.
And I look at everything she missed. And my father passed away when I was in college. And I spent a lot of time looking back. And God bless my husband and children and good friends. You know, you don't want to miss the present because of the pain. So, you know, you're lucky. You're blessed if you can let that go. But I got it. I got what she was putting herself through. She needed it. She needed the pain.
Do we trivialize grief in American popular culture in the, you know, yellow ribbon kind of memorial stuff that happens that doesn't get to this piece that you're talking about here, Joni?
My family always says everybody shows up with a casserole and you really need them 5 months later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You really need them when it's 2 a.m. and you can't sleep because you're missing the person. And for some reason, we tend to leave people alone after the big hoopla. And I get it. But I understand now that it's a long process.
A veteran once said to me that as time goes on, you know, it looks really easy for Americans to say we're all in this together, you know, and stand for the Pledge of Allegiance and I'm with you, solidarity. But as time goes on, the harder thing to say is your life is different from mine because you lost something I didn't lose.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me to understand that? Or can I understand that from you? And that's the harder conversation, and it's the one that we almost never have.
Right. And that's a really important conversation because we can't help each other if we cannot come from a point of connection and understanding it in some way. You know.
And so Trish is trying to maybe have that conversation with her whole big organized charity, sleep transfusion, maybe, you know, get everybody to understand that, you know, we're different, but we share this grief, but it doesn't mean we have to be the same.
You know, I disagree. I don't think Trish is trying that at all. I think she's masking everything.
Yeah.
Really? She's working really hard.
Yeah.
She's pumping. She's a number one salesperson. Mm-hmm. But I think she's not dealing at all.
But if someone had said to her, talk to me about your sister and what you went through, as opposed to her having to use it in her work.
Rather than tell the story.
She might not have had to use it that way.
Yeah.
Had someone said to her, of course, we wouldn't have a story. But that's But if someone had said to her, hey, gosh, you lost your sister over something we're all scared of. That's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to talk about things like cancer? And, you know,
right.
You're scared. You talk about it. It might happen to you. Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
It's this odd, illogical thing that separates us.
Does anybody get in this story that, as you've suggested here, that Trish is using the story of her sister as, in a sense, an act of concealment, almost cowardliness,
oh, sure.
even though everybody says she's so courageous for constantly telling this story.
Well, at the end of the book, she makes there's a great line. It says, "If I stop telling Dory's story, I wonder where will she go?"
Yeah.
And I think that is how she's dealing with her grief, is that if she keeps telling the story, then she's keeping her alive in her world, which is, I think, very common in some one way or another. So she was using this story as a way of keeping her sister alive, but also ignoring dealing with the actual grief of letting her go.
You know, earlier you were talking about fear and love. You were saying when your kids make a decision, you ask them if it's come out of fear or out of love. And that's an excellent question for Trish, really. Was she doing it out of fear or out of love?
Yeah.
People would say it was love, but I think
it was fear.
It's fear. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think this is about sleep or about this whole idea of exchange of human organs, human sperm, human eggs, human blood, and what all of that entails? It really gets into all of it in this one simple idea about sleep.
It does. I think what Ms. Russell does is she takes something like sleep that we take for granted, and she interjects all these other concepts into being able to harvest that, being able to reuse that, being able to exchange something as basic as a good night's sleep.
Yeah, I think that the notion of we are, not to sound dramatic, but killing ourselves because of a lack of intimacy. The whole idea of, you know, we're busier than ever, but we're not doing it in community. And we're plugged into things. In fact, there was a quote about the glowing devices, and you know why we have 24-hour news cycles and polluted skies and crops and waterways and the bald eyeballs of our glowing devices. We Americans are sitting in an electric chair that we have engineered, and that was it's a cautionary tale. I think we are depending on the genuine exchange with another human being less, and she highlights that with, well, it's a crisis. We really need each other. Now what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's so many parts in the book where the exchange between two people has that similar lack of connection.
Yeah, donor. You're
yes,
a donor. Yeah,
a donor and a receiver.
You're not a lover. You're a donor. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
It's partly sci-fi, but it's partly also, you know, sci-fi like psychology fiction, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the sense that it reminded me of that movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with the van outside of the house,
yes,
and they got the weird machine that hooks up to the head, and you know, you kind of believe these doctors, but they're also kind of wacky. You wouldn't necessarily trust them. There's a deliberate ambiguity here. I'm wondering if you felt like you would even get anywhere close to these people if you were an insomniac.
We had that question, which character do you relate to and why? And some people in our book club found it hard to relate to any of the characters, which is interesting. So it was more about the concept than the actual bodies. I personally related to Trish in her sadness and her fear and her panic of losing her sister Dory, who was already dead, by the way. But this notion of, one member of our book club said, you know, Trish bleeds grief. Everybody in the story is bleeding something. And that was powerful, too. So I did relate to her. I wouldn't have wanted to hang out with her, but yeah. I did relate to
her. Well, and the people that ran those companies, you wonder, and it's certainly hinted on during the book, but what their agenda is, what their real, are they trying to save the world because they're suffering with this insomnia, or are they trying to find a solution to the problem to make money or for their own benefit? And I don't know if I would have come 20 feet near those people.
And I think it's directly relatable to today. And I mean, you know, to the Red Cross, to the American Cancer Society. These are big operations. They're doing good, but you have to have a certain fanaticism to generate the interest, to generate the income, to get the money, to do the research. So it does touch of that. You know, it's not so far-fetched. She really gave us not a far-fetched story, but a story that is almost unreachable, but we can put it in today's terms. So,
the themes.
Yeah. And so charity, you know, it sounds good, it looks good, but it has its own demons. And I think she hit it hard.
Lou Elder, Diane Weltman, and Joni Bedina of the Pennsylvania Book Babes discussing sleep donation by Karen Russell. If you want to become part of the Takeaway Book Club, text Book Club to 69866. Remember, standard messaging and data rates apply. You can always text STOP to opt out. Our next book selection is All Our Names by Dinah Mangetsu. Read along with us and share your comments and questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.